This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It's 9:36 in the morning now on this bright and beautiful Monday morning. And it's time now for Pressing Matters. Every Monday, we have, of course, P. Gunasekaram, who's the founding editor of Kini Biz, in the studios with us. Good morning, Guna. How are you?
Morning. Morning, dude.
Okay. And joining us as well this morning, of course, Julian Ng and Kusu Chang. We've got a couple of Pressing Matters to look into, four of which, the first one being falling oil prices. However, there's been a bit of kerfuffle over here. SPAT announced the price hikes, or rather the fare hikes, but the cabinet has said no. So what's happening?
Yeah, I think the timing here was completely off. So if we look at it, the oil prices have been falling quite sharply. The fall is between 40% and 50%, depending on the period
yes.
at which you have taken. But your fares are going up. So the SPAD had announced that this would go up 44% on a per kilometer basis, but the flag down rate will remain unchanged at $3. So if you calculate that for a 5-kilometer journey, which we did at Kini Biz, the increase is about 22%. And for express buses and KTM, the increase is about the same, at slightly more than 20% as well. So the question is, at a time when you're oil prices are falling, why should fares be going up? And the answer, I think, from SPAD has been that there has been no revision for the last 5 or 6 years in taxi fares. You know? And taxi drivers were actually becoming very unruly as a result of that, and charging their own fares and so on. So, but anyway, soon after the SPAD made the announcement, the cabinet has instructed them to defer this to a later date, you know, until after the GST is implemented. You know? But on another matter, I think we should look at the way the oil prices have fallen. But this does not seem to be reflected adequately in the pump prices. Mm. If you look at RON 95 petrol prices, it came down by a fifth between December 1st, 2014 and February 1st this year. But crude oil prices came down 50% during the same period. So the question is, why couldn't the oil price have come down more than that? Perhaps not by 50%, but perhaps, you know, closer to the 50% figure. And between February 1st and March 1st, the price went up for an overall price drop of just 7.5% since the December 2014 period. You know? But if you look at the crude oil price was down 40% when you compare with December last year. Mm. So, but the overall drop in the RON 95 price was just 7.5%. You know? RON 95 is pretty much becoming the standard now, and currently RON 95 and diesel prices are about the same.
I think that there is a need to actually free up the determination of petrol prices, because right now the government determines it according to some kind of calculation that they have, you know, some secret source, and then they churn that to come up with a petrol price. Mm. But this has got repercussions on the inventory management of all these petrol dealers.
That's
right. They can't plan the cost of their inventory and then on charge that to the consumers. If it's freed up, then it is different. It would also will not only reflect international oil prices faster, but it will also allow these petrol dealers to manage their inventory better.
No, Jules, conceptually you're right, and it should be freely floated, but we can't, because Malaysia is an environment where the big hand of the government is involved, and many of these petrol pump operators are basically awardees of Petronas pump licenses, and they can't allow it because, you know, they've got to manage it somehow, right? So everything's interlinked on a political basis here.
The deal was that, I mean, in terms of the petrol price structure, the deal was that the subsidies are removed. So which means the consumer pays the market price for petrol. So that should also mean that if your crude oil prices come down, the consumer should also benefit from the oil price drop fully. So I think for this to take place, I think the government has to disclose its pricing mechanism transparently and fully, and show us the calculations that it uses to set the new petrol prices. You know? I mean, oil prices are still 40% lower than what they were before, you know? But your prices at the pump are down only 7.5%. Why is that? You know? So that's one question.
So the other question is, what is stopping the government from freeing up prices? Why do they want to go through this whole process of just managing petrol prices? They should free that up, right? I'm not sure the reason behind it. I think it has to do with the fear of price racketeering with the consumers, the fear of inflation and so on. But if you allow competition to take place, then that problem would be taken away.
Yeah, one thing is clear though, the bit of a rally we saw, the dead oil bounce in oil prices, it's set to be short-lived, I think, because there's quite a lot of news flow out in terms of US storage facilities being fully utilized by, I think, mid-May, after which all the production that is coming in from all the producers in the US has got nowhere to go, and they're going to be dumped into the broader market. And I think the word we used was oil prices cratering, right? Dodge Dolan this morning talking about how oil prices could hit the mid-30 levels by the middle of this year. So,
about May, June, yeah. That's what
mid-May,
about,
yeah, yeah. Mid-May, June.
Okay, having said that, are petrol prices going to be subjected to GST?
Good question.
I think not. You know, the from I think it's on the exempt list now.
Okay.
Exempt or zero rated list. But the what is happening is that the price mechanism is now set every month.
Okay.
So we are waiting to see come April 1st. You know, at the same day on which GST is going to be implemented.
Yes.
Whether there will be a further drop in petrol prices. So if the prices are actually declining, then there should be, this should be reflected in a drop in petrol prices at the pump. You know, so that should perhaps help to take off some of the price increase that the introduction of GST will do.
Okay, so is it zero rated or tax exempt? That's the big confusion, isn't it, as far as that's concerned?
Yeah. So I mean, when you're talking about GST, there is a lot of considerable amount of uncertainty with GST now. You know, I mean, and there is not enough of clarification coming out. Hopefully, as we go towards the implementation of GST, we will see some clarification. So, from what we understand, both zero rated and exempt in both zero rated and exempt categories, there is no tax which is charged to the final customer. So, however, those in the zero rated supply chain can claim back input taxes, but those in the exempt category can't. So, for instance, rice, for instance, is supposed to be zero rated.
Yes.
So, a rice wholesaler who is charged GST on a service provided. Say, for instance, he uses electricity and then he's charged GST on that. He can claim this back. But if you take another example, service charges for condominium, for instance, these are GST exempt. So there is no GST on the final tax, but the supplier of services for the condominium can't claim back service tax charged by the suppliers. So what he will do then is, he is going to raise his prices because he has experienced price increases.
Yes.
So, and this will be translated to the final customer without there being any GST. So under circumstances like this, you can ask whether, you know, you might as well impose the GST in this case so that some of the revenue goes back to the government. So what's the point of the customer paying higher prices even though, you know, this is exempt.
I absolutely agree with that. And it also ties into my argument earlier about how the government should free up petrol prices as well. I mean, if your intention is to broaden the tax base, then theoretically speaking, none of these goods should be on a list of exempt or zero rated. Mm-hmm. And what you do is from the tax revenue that you raise, you redistribute it back to people who need it the most. So right now, it looks like the list is so complicated and it will turn out to be an administrative nightmare and it would defeat the purpose. You spend more cost in policing the list.
Yeah, some economists believe you should have as few exempt and zero rated items as possible. But I think politically this may have been difficult to do because there would be an increase in prices of what are considered essential goods, you know, rice, cooking oil, and so on. But perhaps for this there can be some clarity from the government in terms of whether they're going to be zero rated or exempted. So if they are zero rated, then it's easier to have no tax for some of the essential goods and services.
So just quickly taking your point of the inflation in needed goods, right? Basic goods inflation. I think that can be actually tackled very easily through a proper redistribution program where you only benefit the poor as well as the lower middle classes and all the rest of the guys, even if they buy 10 or 20 pounds of onions, onions, even onions being a very cheap basic good, they still have to pay GST because they have the means to do so.
To some extent, the government is already doing that. This is the Bantuan Rakyat Satu Malaysia. So where there is a direct distribution of cash to the poor, you know, but even so, when the psychological impact of seeing the prices of essential goods and services going up tends to have a very an impact on accelerating prices, price increases further.
Well, whatever it is, there's a little clock over here, a countdown to the 1st of April 2015. We are 8 days, 14 hours, 13 minutes and 24 seconds away, people. Get ready for that, yeah. We've got
this is not Christmas, you know.
I know. But we're going to cover more topics, including Liu Kee Sin and also the big elephant in the room, 1MDB. Next on Pressing Matters on BFM 89.9. Okay, 9:48 in the morning right now on Pressing Matters. Let's look into a couple of other stories right now. Now, the Royal Commission of Inquiry should investigate 1MDB, so says Guna.
Yeah. Okay, we've done an issue piece on 1MDB, one of, I think, three or four that we have done. Mm-hmm. But essentially, I think if you look at, say, the news is out that the Auditor General is going to investigate 1MDB, but what is not clear is the scope of the investigation. Mm-hmm. How far back is the Auditor General going to do? What is he going to do? And how much is he going to investigate? So I think what we are suggesting is that it's time that you have a Royal Commission of Inquiry to investigate 1MDB. So this such a commission will have extensive powers to investigate, to call witnesses and so on. And it will be possible for the commission to go right down to the point at which 1MDB was set up and what were the events which caused problems at it and so on. Hold to account some people, suggest prosecution of some people if necessary for what they have done, and also look in terms of restitution. You know, if the country has suffered damage as a result, can we get back some of this, and who should be held responsible? So I think it's really high time that a commission like this is considered for investigating 1MDB. I think especially if you look at the Sarawak report, emails and things like that, you know, if these are true, then there are a lot of people outside of 1MDB who had nothing to do with 1MDB who were basically pulling the strings at 1MDB, including people like Joe Low, you know, and also some people who are related to the Abu Dhabi government. So, why does a company which is wholly owned by the Minister of Finance, why does it come under the influence of so many other people, and why are key decisions being taken by others instead of 1MDB in the interest of the nation and the country?
Right? I think that's a fair point, because audits are usually within a defined period, whereas a Royal Commission inquiry might go all the way back to 2008-2009 and then examine exactly what went wrong. It doesn't help that the SecGen of the Ministry of Finance has described this whole 1MDB affair as a small issue. It's not a small issue.
It's not at all.
Yes,
it's almost a 50 billion ringgit issue.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think what is their resolve to go as far as they can on this? I mean, a lot of analysis suggests that the barbarians are at the gate only because, you know, as the Sarawak report suggests, Najib is involved in this, and Najib is now apparently out of favor, and therefore this investigation can be ignited and started, right? But how far will the report go to, or the RCI go to uncover these truths?
Just as an indication of how big this issue is, okay, Malaysia, I think the government goes on a roadshow to promote its global bonds in a couple of weeks' time. And you can bet your bottom dollar that foreign fund managers will be examining them on the 1MDB exposure. If I look at the ratings for Malaysia from all three big houses, I think the most benign is Moody's. They're positive with an A- rating. And then you've got S&P, who are in the middle. They're stable on Malaysia with A-. And then Fitch, of course, a negative outlook with also an A-. But they've said publicly that there's a more than 50% chance they're going to downgrade Malaysia's ratings by the end of the year.
Well, that was before they said that 1MDB is actually not destabilizing.
I saw that statement. Yeah. I wasn't sure whether they were mitigating themselves before downgrading. But be that as it may, Malaysia's fiscal position is under close scrutiny internationally.
That was a very interesting metric. The 1MDB loans, while is a tiny proportion of total banking assets, is actually 20% of banking equity. So
I think, yes, you're talking about, say, roughly about 48 billion in liabilities for 1MDB, out of which at least 46 billion is in loans. And this is at the last available public document, which was March 31st, 2014. The annual report for that figure. So we don't know what exactly is the loan situation now and how much more has been taken. So I suppose in a worst case scenario, you may say that the entire 48 billion is at risk, but hopefully that's not the case now. So, but the I think when the governor was asked this question at a press conference, I was there as well, at this in conjunction with the Bank of Negara annual report release. So without mentioning 1MDB by name, she said she referred to a single highly leveraged entity.
And let's start. So I think calling a spade is the first step.
It's the first step.
Apparently, by law, you can't refer to any organization by name, under the central bank, various legislations which govern the central bank.
I see.
So Dr. Zetti, the governor, said that they have done their stress testing and things like that, and it will not pose a systemic risk to the banking sector, although the profitability of some banks could be affected. The capital ratios will still remain intact.
Okay, what happens if, okay, and we know that 1MDB has a 950 million ringgit standing facility with the government, okay? They've drawn down that to pay for their March US bonds, right? There's another payment due in May, and of course subsequently at intervals after that. If 1MDB should so default on any of its dollar bonds, that's going to trigger a ratings downgrade, which is of course going to hurt the borrowing costs and the credibility of our corporations. And that's, I think, the big concern.
I don't think the government will allow.
They will never allow
that
to happen.
Default.
Yeah.
No, so it's a government. It's a wholly owned government company. The government has to stand by 1MDB.
And
he's got no choice in that matter.
And of course, that for a bigger issue, that is of course the kind of ransom game that is going on, right? Just because we have this ransom that's being held by international bond investors, and the country needs to borrow, and therefore the excuse that is being used that it's only right that the government bails it out, but that actually is not right, right? There's a huge moral hazard problem there. There's a huge corruption implications there.
I think the basic question is, I mean, what has 1MDB been doing about this 46 billion in borrowings that it has chalked up? You know, where exactly is it? What is it doing? What are the returns?
Well, it's been trying to sell its assets, but nobody wants it, right? This IPO now is not going to happen by the looks of it. That's why the finance ministry is saying look for an alternative method, and that's why they've mandated CIMB to look at this.
But even that is a small portion of its total assets. You know, I mean, if you're talking about the power assets, it's about 13 billion at the most. So,
that's,
but you have borrowed 46
that's
billion.
That's value, right? What about real value?
Well, the TRX before it was revalued to about 800 over million, that was bought at cost 400 ringgit per square foot, that tract of land, which is worth almost 3,000 ringgit per square foot, according to recent transactions. So revaluation 30 times more, you know?
Actually, the revaluation gains, there have been substantial revaluations. I think the revaluations alone of the TRX and other land would be about 3.5 to 4 billion.
That's how you make
so
money.
So that helps.
Isn't it?
That kind of helps.
Yeah, kind of helps us.
So take that out, and 1MDB would have lost about that amount over the years already.
Well, you know what they say: having your cake and eating it too is probably what's best describes what happened with Tan Sri Liu Kee Sin. He's become the chairman of Eco World Development Group, while he's still the chairman of
Battersea.
Battersea as well.
He became chairman of Eco World Development Group, and then his deputy at SP Satya, this is Woon Tin Yao, he becomes the executive director at the same place.
No, the headlines actually said he is a non-executive chairman of Eco World. Does that make a difference?
I think I do not know how much of a difference it will make because as far as I can recall, Liu and his son are still major shareholders at EcoWorld Development Group. So they may be the largest single holder itself. And in fact, the purchase of property by another entity called EcoWorld, but which is not linked listed, to EcoWorld Development, yeah. The purchase of this property, which will have quite a huge gross development value of over of something like 12 billion Malaysian ringgit, you know, Liu Kishin is one of the owners for it as well. So when he was asked about conflict of interest at a press conference, this was reported by the Sun, I think, he said that he admitted to the conflict of interest, but he said over his role at Battersea and at EcoWorld, but he says that he has declared this, and it is up to the shareholders to act now. And the shareholders of Battersea, which is SP Sethia with 40%, Sime Darby with 40%, and the EPF with 20%. But it would seem like if you are actually in a conflict situation, isn't it up to you to just step down?
Well, that's the thing. It's a bit of an inverse and a bit of a weird situation because the people that would be aggrieved by this conflict would be really Sethia shareholders, right? Because they would say, yes, why have you got a foot in both companies? Except that in this situation, they don't want him to leave. They want him to stay around because he's the
superstar. He wants to leave.
He's the rock star, right?
Yeah. He wants to leave Battersea, that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, he should.
Because EcoWorld was, you know, the other thing to remember is EcoWorld was built with SP Sethia staff. You know, one analyst report said that 80% of EcoWorld staff are former SP Sethia staff.
That's right. That's right.
SP Sethia 2.0 lah.
Yeah.
Literally, isn't it? Anyway, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and thanks as well to P. Kunasigram, founding editor of KiniBiz. Don't forget, pop over to kinibiz.com if you want more of Guna. And join us again every Monday for Pressing Matters right here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.